Now let me emphasize what were the key ingredients. So yesterday we said, let's suppose I have this powerful operator called the R matrix. And this R matrix, it's a function that takes on two vector spaces, V1, V2, into themselves, into V1, V2. So it takes on product of two vector spaces. Yesterday, each vector space was C2. But now I'm doing a more general thing. I'm saying, suppose I have two vector spaces, and I have an R matrix that acts on vector space 1, vector space 2 into itself, any two vector spaces. Now, this is also a function of a spectral parameter, or rather of a difference, U minus V, which in a picture I can draw like this. I can put an arrow to indicate that these are the incoming indices. So this would be the incoming. And these two legs would be the outgoing. Right? So you act at some state here and you get some state there. And if I put a U associated to this line and a V associated to this line, I think of this as an angle U minus V, and that's the argument of the R matrix. Okay? Is it okay? Good. Now, suppose I have this object. We wrote yesterday its explicit form, but I don't care now. I have some object like this, which obeys this triangular equation. Meaning that if I put here this line U, this line whatever, this line whatever, you see that I put three values for these lines, but at the intersection only the difference matters. So I can put one of them to zero without loss of generality. So then I get this equation, R acting on space, let's see, 1 and 2, and the difference is U minus 0, so just U. Then I continue going up, I have 1 and 3, with the difference U minus V, or sorry, I did a mistake here. I want to put this to be minus V, such that I get what the equations we wrote yesterday. U minus minus V is U plus V. And then the last one, R 2 and 3, acting on 0 minus minus V, which is just R of V. And then I multiply this, and the claim is that I can move this line past and get this identity. So I get this identity on the product of three vector spaces. So this is an identity valid on V1 times V2 times V3, where, of course, when I say 2, 3, I mean I do nothing on V1, and I do R on V2 and V3. Okay? Yes?
So how do you know which one to subtract from which? Like what in the notation do you use?
I put the two incoming arrows. And I do it counterclockwise.
Okay.
That's okay, right? So I have two arrows coming in, wherever they are oriented. I just read it counterclockwise. Okay, good. Now, suppose we have this object, right? It could be the one we constructed yesterday or any object that obeys this algebra. Now, we know that this is a very powerful ingredient because if we construct this object, then we can construct this object next, which is the monodromy matrix, which is just a sequence of these objects. And by multiplying many, we construct the spin chain. Now we have sites 1, 2, 3, up to L. Now we construct the big, long object. So we have a spin chain here in the bottom. And here in the top, we have an auxiliary space, a new space, 0. Okay? So this is an object that acts on a spin chain. And what does it do on the spin chain? Depends what I do with this auxiliary space. If I insert a spin and then I put an opposite spin here, that spin needs to go somewhere. So it's a kind of creation operator on the spin chain. If I remove a spin, I put spin down and here I put spin up, then it's the opposite. It must work as an annihilation operator. That spin down must go somewhere here. If I put a spin up and spin up, it acts more or less like sigma z. It can change the spins a little bit, but it doesn't change the total spin component. So this is a set of operators that act on the Hilbert space depending on what I choose for my auxiliary space. Now, I can think of this object, right? I can think of this object here containing these operators that depend on what I put here and here. In other words, it's a matrix of dimension of V0 times dimension of V0 matrix. I can think of it like that. With entries that act on the Hilbert space. Yesterday, V was C2 again, so it's a 2 by 2 matrix with elements A, B, C, D. But what I, but more general, it could be a bigger matrix. The elements of this matrix, be it 2 by 2 or be it bigger, obey an algebra given by this equation here that tells you that if I multiply L of U followed by L of V followed by R of, in this case, V minus U, in this picture, so I put first U, then V, it's probably flipped. So this object here is equal to the same thing written in opposite order because I can use Young-Baxter one by one to move these lines. And this gives me an algebra because here I have a matrix times another matrix times a matrix equal to the matrix in opposite order. So when I look at the elements of this matrix, I'll get a particular algebra. Good. So that's one thing that we gain from this operator R. The second important thing is that we get a family of commuting operators. T of U commuting with T of V, where T of U is obtained by tracing over the auxiliary space over this monodromy matrix. So we get rid of the auxiliary space. Now it's an operator going from the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space. Okay? And then, furthermore, if at a particular value the R matrix simplifies and becomes the permutation operator, then we are guaranteed that the derivatives of log of T give local Hamiltonians, summation Hamiltonians that act on a local subset of spins.
Do you make N in the derivative?
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Thanks. Right? So then they yield local commuting Hamiltonians. And we saw one case yesterday when we had N equals 1 and V was C2 where we got the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. And the reason is that if this R of 0 is permutation, T of 0 is just a shift operator, T prime of 0 is just shift to the back. So when you do T of 0 times T minus 1, you do almost nothing. When you do T prime or times T minus 1, sorry, you do almost nothing, except taking the derivative of R. So the, it's a local Hamiltonian whose Hamiltonian density is the derivative of R. Okay? Roughly related to the derivative of R. Okay? But it's local because we do something at some point and we do everything else to the right, everything else to the left, so it ends up being something local. Okay, so this, you see, motivates you to think that this construction is powerful. It allows us to construct this Hamiltonian. And the fourth point, sorry, fourth point, is that using the elements of L hat, we can diagonalize T, and therefore the Hamiltonian H. In particular, we saw that the eigenstates could be written in our case. So for V equal to C2, if all Vs are C2, which was the case we did yesterday, we had this operator B, which was one of the off-diagonal elements of L, and we just multiply a bunch of Bs together with arguments U1 up to UN, acting on the ferromagnetic vacuum, and this was an eigenstate. And again, we could see it because we could commute the A's through the B's using this algebra, and the action of the A's and the D's on the vacuum were simple, and we could work it out. Okay? So this is a summary of what we have seen yesterday. Right. So is it clear? So now, you see that, imagine you want to find some integrable model, some model like this, with some other different symmetry group, where the V is a bigger, it's not C2, but it's some bigger representation. So it is C3, C4. You just write an ansatz for R, and you would fix the coefficients of your guess for R, such that this identity would be satisfied. Right? And once that is the case, then you can run the machinery that we did yesterday. Okay, the key thing is finding R matrices that obey this equation here. I just gave you one for free, but it's very easy to construct them more generally. You see that R is fixed in this equation up to an overall function, because if I multiply by any function, it is still true. Right? So in our example, for example, what we saw was that the R matrix was given by up to an overall function. So let me say that the identity comes with coefficient 1. So our R matrix that we found was 1 plus the permutation operator times some function of u minus v, right? Or let me do the following. Let me do the opposite. Sorry. Let me say it was, let me normalize the permutation operator to be 1 plus the identity times a function of u minus v. Okay? Now, this function, I remind you yesterday, this function was u minus v over I in our normalization because we put I times permutation plus u minus v. Okay? But suppose we did not know what this function was. Well, but now, given this blackboard, we know that it would be great to find such function such that Young-Baxter would be satisfied. So what would I do? I would take this ansatz, and notice this is the most general ansatz I can do with SU2 symmetry. Because when I act with two spins with SU2 symmetry, either I do nothing or I permute them. There's nothing else I can do which doesn't break SU2 symmetry. So if I want to study SU2 spin chains, this is already the most general ansatz I could write if I want to study spin chains in the fundamental representation. And then what would I do? I would take this ansatz and I would plug it into the Young-Baxter relation. Right? I would plug this ansatz into this equation here and I would get an equation for F that would take the following form. And I leave it this as an exercise. It will tell you that F of u plus v equal to f of u plus f of v. Okay? That's what you would get from that equation there. And this is the definition of a linear function. Okay? So this is how you define a linear function. So this implies automatically that f of u equal a times u. And A is not relevant. A, you can always reshift U to absorb it, and you get this example. Okay? Now, if you want to study theories with other symmetries, so this was for SU, this is, you could say, why is this for SU2 and not for SUN? And indeed, this is true for SUN. So what I did here was true for any SUN. If you want to generalize from SU2 to SUN, again, when you act on SUN, fundamental, all you can do is do nothing or permute, and this would still be true. Okay? Good. Okay, I think I'll stop here about this. Now let me just conclude concerning this operator here. What did we see? We saw that the transfer matrix of u acting on psi was equal to an eigenvalue that took the following form, u plus I over 2 to the L, times from commuting the A operators through the B's, we got this product. And then from commuting the D operators through the B's, we got the complex conjugate term. Times psi. And then we got a bunch of bad terms plus some bad terms. And what were these bad terms? Were a sum of some alpha j times some states psi j rather than psi, where this psi j were given by almost psi, except that uj is not there. And instead, I have just u. So this is not proportional to the state. So what I have to set is I have to set an equation that says alpha j equal to 0 for j equal 1 up to n. And that gives me a set of equations that quantize, that tell me what this u case should be. But the shortcut, as I told you, is look at this expression. And this expression, it looks like it has poles when u is equal to uk. But it cannot, because we are diagonalizing a polynomial equation, which is just a product of R matrices. So this falls, the residue must be zero. So let's go to the residue. When u is equal to uk, what do you get from this equation? You get that this over this must be zero, the residues must cancel. So you see that the residue of the eigenvalue, which is t of u, when u equal to uj, would give, equals zero, would give a set of equations of the form uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the L times a product over the other guys, k not equal to j up to n, uj minus uk minus I over uj minus uk plus I must be equal to 1. Okay? And this gives me a set of equations for j equal 1 up to n. And they better be the same equations as this, otherwise I would get too many equations. And indeed, they are the same equations as what I get from here. Right? Because these equations must be true, because the I cannot get poles. These equations must be true, because I want to diagonalize the operators. But given that I already have one equation for each variable, they better be the same, and indeed, they are the same. Okay? The honest thing to do is, of course, to do this thing here. Okay. Now let me go on. Actually, what I wrote here is not correct. This is not correct. This is the eigenvalue for a slightly shifted value here. This is the eigenvalue actually when I put here u I over 2. I forgot if it's minus or plus. Let me put minus, and if it's plus, I'll fix it, because a minus you can flip to a plus. Okay, so any question here? So this is what we saw yesterday. Okay. Yeah, it's minus over. Yeah. Any questions so far? Now, let's go on, because we did not finish deriving what I wrote yesterday in the upper right corner, because these are a set of equations that the U's must satisfy. But I remind you that the Hamiltonian was a log derivative of T, and therefore the energy is the log derivative of the eigenvalue T of U, the derivative where U equal to 0. Okay. Maybe with some minus lambda over I. So you see that what you have to do is take the derivative of this expression when u is equal to 0. But it's the derivative I have to shift back, u to u plus I over 2, and then put u equal to 0. But you see that what happens when I put that argument equal to 0 is that this term here is equal to 0. Right? When I plug the argument of t, when I make u equal I over 2 there, this term here is equal to 0. Is it clear? So the derivative comes only from this term here. So the derivative becomes minus lambda over I, derivative with respect to u, of log of that first term, and I'm shifting now back, u plus I to the power L times the product of u minus uk minus I over 2 over u minus uk plus I over 2 when then I put u equal to 0.
So did you mean I by 2?
Here? Or here?
Yeah.
Here, no. I meant I, right? Because this is this expression here. This is the eigenvalue t at u minus I over 2. So I have to shift u by plus I over 2, and I get u plus I here.
you cannot really neglect the other term, right?
Sorry?
You cannot really neglect the other term because the derivative will hit the other guys.
No, no, of course I can. So let me, if you want, I can write plus u to the L times some product. Right? So when the derivative acts, I still get 0 because L is bigger than 1. So if the derivative will act here or here, it doesn't matter. After I plug u equal to 0, it never contributes. The second term never contributes. So what do we get? When the derivative acts here, I get, let me write what I get and then you'll tell me if it's correct. L times lambda, that's from this term. Let's see if it works. Because we take the derivative, we get L times 1 over u plus I. We put u equal to 0, so we get L over I times I gives a minus sign, so we get lambda times L. That's from the first term. Now, derivative of log of this. It's derivative of log of this minus derivative of log of this. Log of this, the derivative gives the inverse of this. Log of this, the derivative gives the inverse of this. And I put u equal to 0, so I get plus a sum of lambda. As we said, derivative of this guy, 1 over, and then we put u equal to 0, so minus uk minus I over 2, minus derivative of this guy, and then we put u equal to 0, minus uk plus I over 2, sum over k, right, because product becomes a sum inside the log, and concerning the i's, I have minus, and I have lambda over I. Okay? Now, let's hope it works. So if I put this guy here, the I over 2 doubles, it cancels the I. And downstairs, I get minus uk squared minus 1 quarter, but there is a minus. So we get lambda times L plus sum from k equal 1 up to n of lambda over uk squared plus 1 quarter, which was what we had written in the blackboard. Okay? And I must be careful because if you remember, I forgot, but this is not the energy. This was this what we were getting was just a sum of permutations. So this is the energy plus lambda times L because we did not have the identity there. So if I want to compute the energy, I cross out this. And this is really what the energy is. Okay. Oof, finally. So any question here? This took much longer than
can
I wanted,
repeat,
but okay.
Sorry, can you repeat the argument of the sum of lambda times L in the energy?
Here?
Why did you sum?
Because I remind you that this Hamiltonian that we were getting here was just a sum of permutations. But the Hamiltonian we wanted was sum of permutations minus the identity. Right? So from this Hamiltonian we got minus lambda times sum of permutations. Mm-hmm. But what we want is minus lambda times sum of permutations minus the identity because we wanted to normalize the ferromagnetic vacuum to have zero energy. And you see that it works because if I put n equal to zero, I'm saying that the energy is zero. So that's the convention that we had before. For the ferromagnetic vacuum, we start with zero. Putting a constant here is just a shift. Doesn't matter. But our convention was that it was zero when I put no particles. So it should be just that.
Okay,
more questions?
What was the motivation for asking that the residues of T vanish?
Was the statement that T is a polynomial because T is just a product of R matrices and each R matrix was a polynomial. So polynomial cannot, the eigenvalues of a diagonalizing a polynomial operator cannot have poles. Right? You just get a, you have just a polynomial. So it cannot be that as you are moving u, things start exploding. Yeah?
Sorry, but I think that I'm getting an overall minus sign in the sum, perhaps. I may be wrong, but if you put the minus sign in the first equation to the inside, you can cancel the minus signs downstairs. Right? So you would have 1 over u plus I over 2 minus 1 over u minus I over 2. Now if you put it together, okay.
It's okay, no?
It's okay?
I think so.
I'm just being stupid.
Ah, There might be an overall minus sign, indeed. Well, remind me, lambda was positive for ferromagnetic, so this result should be correct. So if there is an overall minus sign, it's because there was already an overall minus sign missing somewhere before. The final equation should be correct as is, because I want the ground state to be positive, and now I want to add energy. So the final result is correct. Okay. Finally, let's then move to some interpretation, as we said, of this result. So this is what we derived. So we derived this expression for the energy. So this is the spectrum where the U's obey these equations here. Right. Now here is the interpretation. So now we move to the physical interpretation. So, but any question on the derivation? Is everything clear? Or yeah.
I want to press you a little more on this question I asked before. I'm not really happy with your answer. So you derive this equation as the equivalent to this constraint that the residues vanish?
Yeah.
So then presumably if the U's didn't satisfy those values, then the residues wouldn't vanish, right?
If the U's did not obey this equation, these residues here would not vanish, yeah.
Yeah, so then what you said before is probably not a very deep answer or something, like, you know what I mean? Like, those equations are really important, and they're equivalent to this constraint.
No, but it's not important, it's not inconsistent, because they will not satisfy this equation.
I'm not saying it's not inconsistent, I'm just saying that your previous answer to my question probably wasn't a very full answer or something. Like, there's probably something more. You just said, oh, it's a polynomial or something, but obviously, only if it satisfies these complicated relations on the U's.
Right, but be careful, because what we would say is that these terms here would also diverge and cancel the corresponding singularities. So I'm saying that if I can drop these terms, this is the full thing. If this is the full thing, it cannot have singularities. Now, if this is not the full thing, it might have singularities canceled by some terms here. So when it diagonalizes the operator, these terms are not there, then this is the eigenvalue, and the eigenvalue cannot have singularities. Now, if this is not the eigenvalue, but just some part of the result that I don't care, then I don't know. But as I said, the honest way, and it's easy to do, maybe for the last tutorial, one of the points will be that, is to show that canceling these terms give bit equations. And then, as a cross-check, you see that, oh, nicely, they also make sure that the residue is a polynomial. See, because this condition means that this is a polynomial. Right now, this is a polynomial, because it has no residue, so this is a polynomial. It doesn't look like, but it is a polynomial. Okay? And these conditions give these equations that in turn imply that this is a polynomial, and everything is good. Okay? Do you want me to do this computation, just so that you complete the full picture? I mean, it's easy. And, no? Okay. So let's go on into the physical picture of these equations. And the claim is the following. So these conditions here, these are some quantization of the spectrum of my Hamiltonian. Of course, it makes sense, because the spectrum is at finite volume, is a spin chain of length L. So the spectrum should be discrete. I should not be able to just write continuous families of eigenstates. The spectrum is discrete, and there are 2 to the L states with some discrete spectrum. So where do we see normally quantization of spectra in quantum mechanics? A simple example is when we put a free particle in a circle, and we get just e to the I p l equal to 1, saying the momenta of the particle, the waves, must have some the wavelength must be a multiple, must be an integer such that I close the wave function, right? So momenta must be 2 pi n over L. So these equations should be a bit similar, and indeed, you see that we get something here to the power L, okay? So let me define the analog of momenta. Let me define uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 let me define this as e to the I pj. So I change variables from u to p. Okay? The inverse transformation, if you want, is that uj is equal to 1/2 cotangent of pj over 2. So you do this change of variable, this is equivalent. And under this change of variables, the previous equations become e to the I pj times l times product of k not equal to j of some complicated function. You see, u is cotangent, so it's cotangent minus I, cotangent minus cotangent plus I. Let me call that function s of uj and uk equal to 1. So we solve these equations now. Sorry, not u, p. P and p equal to 1. And then the energy, I plug this value of u here for the energy. Right? And for the energy, I get that the energy is equal to lambda times the sum of 2 minus 2 cosine of pj. Okay, so now things start to be familiar. So this now looks like a moment of a particle going around the ring. And remember this expression. This was the energy of a magnon that we saw in the first lecture. This was nothing but the energy of a magnon for a magnon. So you see that when n is equal to 1, what we are getting makes perfect sense. What we are saying is that when n is equal to 1, the wave function that we wrote in the first lecture, e to the ipn, was totally fine, except that I needed to be periodic because I put it on a circle. So I would get just e to the ip times l equal to 1. That would be just periodicity for the wave function we wrote in the first lecture, when we said that the wave function for a single excitation was just e to the ip times n. Okay, so this is just periodicity for that wave function. The magnon goes around, the total phase is 1. And once I quantize the moment of the magnon, the energy is the energy of the magnon. So this is a generalization for many magnons. This is just saying how the moment of many magnons is quantized. Right? So these equations that we derived in a rather mathematical way, so this is the quantization condition for a system of n magnons. And the picture that goes with this equation is the following. So we are interpreting this equation. So what are we seeing? We are seeing that particle J goes around the spin chain and comes back. Right? And this would give e to the I momentum of particle J times L. That's a phase acquired by propagation around the ring. But as it goes around the ring, the phase has some phase shifts whenever it encounters any of the other particles. So these other particles would be any k which is not J. And this is J. And whenever the particle encounters the other particle, it acquires some phase shift, e to the I delta, which would be the S matrix between uj and uk. It would be a small phase shift because the particle passes by the other particle, so the phase changes by the effect of the other particle. And indeed, this is a phase, you see, this is the complex conjugate of this. So it's a nice phase shift. Okay? So basically, what we are seeing is that S of P and Q, this is the S matrix between, this is the S matrix between two magnons of momentum P and Q. So we have a matrix P and Q. We are in two dimensions, so when things scatter, momentum is conserved because of conservation of momentum and energy. When two particles scatter, their momentum is conserved. And what we are saying here is that this object here, S, that we computed, it's a non-trivial function. Again, it's 1/2 cotangent of P minus 1/2 cotangent of Q minus I divided by the complex conjugate. It's a non-trivial function that we computed. Is the S matrix for the two magnets. And what we are saying by this picture, by saying that the total phase is equal to 1, we are saying that particle J, right? So this is what? It's particle J going around the world, scattering with everyone else. This would be everyone else, right? So there will be a bunch of lines here. This would be K, all K not equal to J. And we are saying that the effect of scattering with everyone else can be decomposed into a sequence of just scattering with the individual guys. Okay? So here what we are saying is that for this interpretation to be correct, we are saying that the scattering factorizes. Right? That is into a sequence of 2-2-2 scattering events. Because in practice, the scattering, the phase acquired by meeting with everyone, is the same as meeting first with one, then with two, then with three, in a sequence. And this is a definition, this is the definition I like the most, of what is called an integrable theory. It's a theory where the scattering factorizes, and all that matters is the two-body scattering event. So this is the interpretation of these equations. I mean, the equations are definitely correct. We are trying to come up with a physical picture about this factorization. Why this scattering event breaks down into a sequence of scattering events. Okay? And the question that you could ask now, a physical question, is we could ask here, why? Okay? Okay, and the reason is because we have all these conserved charges. And when we have all these conserved charges, it means that when we scatter now not just two particles, but three, four, five particles, because they are conserved, these charges, it happens that the moment of the initial particles must be equal to the moment of the final particles. Again, in two dimensions, that's obvious for two particles, because you have conservation of energy and momentum, so the final and the initial momentum must be the same. But for more particles, it's not true. Three momenta can be conserved, and the energy can be conserved, and they can go to very complicated things in the out state. But if more charges are conserved, it implies that the set of momenta is equal to the set of momenta. And the only reasonable explanation for that is if the scattering is factorized. Otherwise, you would not be able to explain why the set of momenta would be conserved. But one way to explain is to say that in practice, they are happening in a 2x2 basis. But let's see this more explicitly. Let's see this more explicitly in the following way. We said that we have this Hamiltonian, H, and our Hamiltonian was this, was the sum of permutations minus the identity. But yesterday in the tutorial, you constructed another Hamiltonian that commutes with H, which was obtained by taking two derivatives there, and what you got was this, that you got this term minus this term. Right? So this Hamiltonian, you see, this Hamiltonian here, acting on a state of a single magnet, one magnet, I remind you, it gave what? It gave, from this permutation, it gave twice cosine of P, and from this term, it gave minus twice times the state psi. Okay? Now, if you act here with this h tilde on the state with one magnet, what do you get? Actually, I should have done this exercise before, but let's see. Do you get sine of 2p times the state? Or is that more? Let's see. So n, what happens? I act and the spin, the spin can move two sides to this side, it can move two sides to this side. So this contribution is definitely there. Is there something else? Could also. I suspect, okay, if I do it on the blackboard, I might get it wrong. But the point is that it's another function, f of p. If this function is not well computed, please compute it properly, but it doesn't matter for the argument. What matters is that it's a new function, not this function. And this is epsilon of p. Okay, and this is a new function. We could call it epsilon tilde of p. It's okay. And what's important is that this new Hamiltonian is a symmetry of my system. It commutes with my Hamiltonian. And now I'm annoyed that I'm not getting this equation right. Let me get this equation right. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So. Yes.
So, which Hamiltonian should I think of as the fundamental Hamiltonian for this?
Well, that depends on your material in the lab. For us, we like to think of H as being the Hamiltonian and H tilde as being a symmetry. But maybe if it's some, if you put a bit more carbon and potassium, it could, you could generate a second Hamiltonian. Yeah. That depends on the material. What we know is H is the simplest one. So, okay, any other questions? Okay, very good. So now, let's consider a particle moving on the spin chain. Okay. Now, a particle moving on the spin chain, if I want to consider really a realistic particle, some excitation, I should not consider e to the ipn because that's a delocalized plane wave. I should consider a wave packet. A wave packet is really localized. Okay? Like in quantum mechanics, when you consider a particle is not e to the ipx. That's totally delocalized in space. It's a wave packet that is localized in space and moves. Right? So let's consider an excitation, a wave packet, that is moving with some velocity v. How do we do it? We say that this is some object with some momentum p that is centered around some momentum k. So p is roughly k. Okay? And then we have the wave packet psi with momentum p for a single magnet, right? So this is just what we wrote yesterday, 2 days ago. And there is the time evolution minus I times the energy of that object P. Okay? So this is my wave packet. So this is my wave packet. So if I consider what's the wave packet in position n, I'll get this in position n. Right? Okay, good. And then let me just remind you then what happens is basically you ask for what is the stationary phase of this wave packet. This wave packet is stationary. The stationarity of the phase at the momentum of my wave packet at p equal k leads to the equation minus time times derivative with respect at k with the energy, and then from this term plus k times n equal to zero. Sorry, plus n equal to zero, derivative with respect to p. Right? And this is, of course, telling you that this is the velocity and that we have that n is equal to the velocity. N is equal to the velocity times t. So my wave packet starts at some time equals zero. At time equals zero, at x equals zero, and then moves with some velocity v. And indeed, if you plot this function here, that's exactly what you get, where the velocity is the derivative of the energy. So this is the velocity of a particle, right? In quantum mechanics, this is p squared over 2, and the velocity becomes p. But in general, this is what the velocity is. Do you agree? Good. Now, suppose we prepare three wave packets that are designed to meet at the same position in spacetime. Okay? So they are very carefully prepared such that the particles will scatter in the same position of spacetime. Right? And there is some probability amplitude for this process, namely some in state going to some out state. This is the same as the probability process if I act with some symmetry generator, H tilde, on this process. Because H tilde is a symmetry, it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So that's the definition of a symmetry. Right? Is it clear? Any symmetry? Probability amplitude. So, but what does this H tilde do? If we act with H tilde, if we act here, let me write it in orange, with e to the I beta times H tilde, what does it do? H tilde acts trivially on the one magnon state, right? It just gives me this function, e tilde of p. So it would just add here, plus e tilde of p times beta. Do you agree? So it would change this equation by adding here e tilde prime of k. So what happens is that this wave packet got shifted and now is here, where this shift, this delta n, is minus epsilon prime of k times beta. Okay, so this is a momentum dependent shift. It's a shift of my wave packet, which is momentum dependent, depends on k. Right? And because it depends on k, it means that this wave packet, so carefully prepared to scatter at the same time, after I act with them, I get three wave packets that now no longer meet at the same time, but rather draw a picture similar to the ones we had seen for this Young-Baxter equation. Where now, indeed, the scattering of particle 1 with the other ones, I can think that 1 first scatters with 2, and only much later scatters with 3. And that's the explanation of the factorization. So that shows that the existence of these higher charges has an important physical implication, which is when you consider particles on this model, these particles will scatter in a factorized way. Okay? So this is an important physical consequence of the existence of these local commuting charges. Okay? So this implies, this explains this factorization that we observe.
Understood. This looks like one of the pictures from the Yang-Bax equation.
Yes.
That's not a coincidence, right?
No, it's not a coincidence, but it should not be confused that the physical meaning here is not the same. The R matrix was not the S matrix. The R matrix was an auxiliary object used to define integrable models. And this is an S matrix. It's the physical phase shift when two magnons pass by each other. But the picture is similar, and indeed, I'll come back to it tomorrow with some further connections. But a priori, yeah, it is. It's true that it, we should keep it in mind, yeah?
For this, you just need one extra charge.
For this, you just need one extra charge, yeah.
So
that's
you,
true.
You always have factorization. You don't need infinity man.
Yeah, so, but typically what happens is that when you have one extra, you will have many more. But that's related to what I said yesterday when people were asking me, are they always local? And at some point, they become very large, the range. But as you see, we don't need that many. One is already very powerful, right? So if we, perhaps you could imagine some very, very crazy configuration where we just with one, you would not be able to separate them out all. But yeah. But in principle, I agree. One is enough. OK. So this is the interpretation of this equation. And now, let me see how easy it is. Okay. I would like to make just one more comment, which is that the S matrix, when the particles have the same momenta, u is equal to minus one. Okay? Or the same p, doesn't matter. But the S matrix have equal momenta are equal to minus one. So the interpretation here is that if the particles are becoming almost parallel to each other, it's costing a minus one to swap them. Okay? So it means that we should think of these magnons. This is an exclusion. These magnons, they behave as fermions. And the state psi, which depends on u1 up to un, there is an exclusion principle where all these u's must be different. Okay? Otherwise, the wave function is zero. Okay? This is just, you can just, if you check the wave function, you can check that the wave function vanishes when two u's are the same. Okay. I think what I wanted to do next will take more than 5 minutes. I think today I'll stop here. In time, even 5 minutes before time. You should cherish this moment. Yeah, it's very rare. Very good. Yes.
Yeah, so that psi is built by taking the vacuum and applying B of u to it, right?
That's right.
And the B of u and B of v commute.
That's right.
So if in that thing I swap a ui and a uj, I don't get a minus. Isn't that strange for fermions?
No. Let me write explicitly what these wave functions are. B of U1 acting on the vacuum gives something. The concept of proportionality depends on your normalization for the R matrix, but gives something like this. It's a sum from n equals 1 up to L, U1 plus I over 2, U1 minus I over 2 to the power n times everyone up except someone down at position n, and then everyone up. So this is what we saw the other day, right? This, indeed, is just e to the I p1, and this is what we wrote in the first time. Now, b of u2 times b of u1 acting on the vacuum. By the way, just before I write that one, I can tell that if you want to check this, it's a nice exercise, because what are you doing? You are doing the following. Let's do it a bit more explicitly. We are saying that we start, we put spins down here, spins up everywhere, right? And what is the B operator? The B operator inserts a spin down here and puts a spin up here. So this spin down must go somewhere. So let's suppose it goes here. And then everyone else is up. Up, 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 up. Then in these intermediate lines, I must have down for sure. Down, down, down. And in these ones, I must have up. And now the weight of each vertex I know. And the fact that I put this guy to the left or to the right means that I will have more and more and more weights. And that's where this power n comes from. So you can really just compute the weight of this diagram when this guy is at position n. And this is what gives you this, up to a constant of proportionality. Now, if I act with two of these guys, now what I would do is I would act with two of them, and the spins, flips go somewhere, for example, here and here, and I insert them here and here. And I can actually think, there's a nice way of thinking about this, which is I'm injecting the spin, and the spin can only move right and up, right? So I can think of this as like if it was water in a pipe. Like there is some water coming here, and the water does this, 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 and this water does this. And I sum over all these possible paths. Okay? And I sum over these paths of water that go like this, and that have to come out here. Then I get a wave function, which is the following. I get a summation of n smaller than m, the position of the two spins. Right? This is what is going to multiply the ket nm. And the wave function is, with this notation, e to the I pn plus I qm, where p and q are related to u1 and u2, plus the S matrix of p and q times e to the I qn plus IPM. Okay? Now this is the interesting part, but okay, if you want, this will not be invariant under flipping P and Q. So if I put, I can put like this, 1 over square root of S of P and Q here. But this is just normalization, this is not important. It's proportional to. Now, this expression here, it's invariant under flipping P and Q, because when you flip P and Q, S goes to 1 over S, so this is constructed to be invariant under flipping P and Q. But you see that when P is equal to Q, this becomes equal to this, this becomes minus 1, and they cancel. Okay? So it's just a statement, even functions can still be zero at the origin. Now, this is a statement that this is the state with two particles. It looks like an incoming plane wave plus an S matrix times an outgoing plane wave. And indeed, the relative coefficient between an incoming wave and an outgoing wave is what you would call the S matrix. So that just gives further evidence that our interpretation was correct. More questions? We have lots of time for questions. We ended up so early. So, yeah.
So in other definitions of integrable systems, like the one that we have in, say, classical mechanics, there's this, again, you have these higher charges, but there you say that on phase space, the Hamiltonian vector fields, the sort of close to a torus. Now, in principle, are these the same kinds of charges that you have?
So classical mechanics, it's about the number of charges.
Right.
Number of charges in quantum mechanics is a bad definition because any matrix, I can diagonalize it and find matrices that commute with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like all quantum mechanical models are integrable. What's key is locality. Also in classical mechanics, when you say these charges, implicitly you are saying that the charges are some integral of some local density. So here the key thing is that these guys have local commuting charges. So some people like to say that the definition of integrability is the existence of this type of relations. The fact that these define an infinite set of commuting charges. So some people like this equation a lot, they say this is the definition of integrability. Plus some small assumption like this that tell you that not only they all commute with each other, but they generate local stuff. So some people would say locality, which is easy, plus that equation is what they would call integrability. I prefer that one, which says that physical particles, when I do a scattering experiment, I prepare many magnons in the past, and I get the same momenta in the future. More like an experimentalist definition, if you want. So what I'm going to do next is, now we got some set of equations that describe the spectrum of the chain. And these equations, the claim is if you solve them for various n's, give you all the energy levels of the spin chain. So for example, as an exercise, you can try to solve them with n equals to 2. And you can play a little bit, and you'll see it's not totally trivial, but you can just solve. But now what we can do is use these equations and solve them in some particular cases. Let me even before just emphasize something very important that I forgot to emphasize. These equations we can put in a computer and solve with L equal 200 and N equal 50. It's easy. You can solve them. This is totally unthinkable from the point of view of diagonalizing an Hamiltonian of 2 to the 200 by 2 to the 200. This is totally impossible. You would never be able to brute force diagonalize an Hamiltonian of 200 sites. Here you can do 200, you can do 1 million, you can do whatever you want. The complexity here, it's linear. The complexity here is linear. It grows polynomially with L and N. Whereas the complexity of diagonalizing a spin chain Hamiltonian, whose Hilbert space is 2 to the L, is exponential. So that's a huge, that's huge. That's very, very important. So these equations, it's true that it's still complicated to solve these equations, but it's much, much simpler than diagonalizing an Hamiltonian. Right? We solved that problem completely. And now, in particular, a nice application of this is, well, but if it describes the full spectrum, why don't I take these nice polynomial equations and plug n to be L over 2? That is, I put as many magnons as half of the spin chain. Why? Because that's what I need if I want to study the antiferromagnetic vacuum, where I go really, really, really far. I put so many magnons, they are all crammed together, and they form the antiferromagnetic state. Now, it might be complicated, but it's a technical complication. We can look at these equations, put our sleeves up, and plug n equal L over 2 and try to attack them, and start studying the physics of the antiferromagnetic vacuum. So understanding spinons and fractionalization will be about understanding these equations when L is very large and n is close to L over 2, which is what we are going to do tomorrow. Okay, cool. See you tomorrow then.